Good afternoon, everybody. Thank you. I love people who can take a hint. I'm Bruce Wingus. I'm president of the Akron Press Club. I'd like to welcome you to today's lunch. Just a couple of things before we get started. Again, thanks for your support. It's through your support that we fund scholarships for young communications professionals, so thank you for doing that for us. After Jason's presentation, we'll have time for questions. And so there should be some white pieces of paper or cards on your table so you can think of your questions during the presentation. Silence your cell phones. Just a couple of things we've got coming up. We'll have the annual State of the Schools address for the Akron Public Schools coming up on February 13. And if you really want to plan ahead, we've got the State of the County address coming up from the County Executive on August 30th. So you can mark that on your calendars now. Now it's my pleasure to introduce Andrew Meyer, the news director of WKSU, and he will be introducing our speaker and handling the questions. Thanks for showing up.
Hi. Jason Segedy is Akron's director of planning and urban development. He became an assistant to the mayor in this area in 2016. He has 20 years of experience in transportation and urban planning. Segedy holds a bachelor's degree in geography from the University of Akron, go Zips, and a master's degree in geography and urban planning from the University of North Carolina at Charlotte. He describes himself as an urban planner, a writer, a music geek, cynical idealist, and tireless advocate for the city. Ladies and gentlemen, thank you for being here. Help me welcome Jason Segedy to the stage.
So, good afternoon, everyone. I think I know at least half of you, and that's even more impressive that you decided to show up and listen to me talk. So, thanks for coming out. I've got probably 20, 25 minutes of material to just kind of talk about where we've been in Akron and where we're going. And then, as was indicated, we'll have time for questions. So to get started, I want you to think about those two words on this slide as we go through, because I think it's very important with urban revitalization. So I've got a little Q&A of my own. Does anybody know what that is? You could just shout it out. It's in Europe. Yes, Berlin Wall. So I actually took that picture in 1987, and that's me standing in front of the Berlin Wall in March of 1987. A lot more hair then. But that was such a formative experience for me, going to Germany and going to Berlin. And you know, just for context, that wall was built in 1961. I was there in 1987, so that was, it had been standing for 26 years. And I don't know if you saw in November, it was the 28th anniversary of the wall coming down. So that wall actually has been down longer than it stood. But I remember at the time we went through Checkpoint Charlie, the Russians searched our bus coming back. I actually got to go to East Berlin, which was really unusual. But no one thought that wall was coming down 2 years from the time that I was there. And I think a lot of times when we make predictions or forecasts about things, we don't always know what the future has in store. So this is another photo for you to guess. Anybody know where this is? This is in North America. This is a tougher one. So this is actually Brooklyn in 1977. So this is right after a blackout, after garbage strikes, after some minor rioting, after the Ramones probably just played at CBGB's, and when punk rock was getting really big, because New York was a mess. And you know, a lot of you probably remember the movie Escape from New York, which I think was early 80s, but in the 70s, New York City lost 800,000 people. And I don't think anybody in 1977 would have told you that over the next 40 years, the city's gonna gain 1.5 million people. It's gonna be so expensive that nobody's gonna be able to afford in neighborhoods. This is actually in Bedford-Stuyvesant in Brooklyn, which is now a very gentrifying neighborhood where rents are really going up. And again, I think, you know, no one would have probably told you that New York could turn around. So you guys probably know where this is, right? Yeah, this is Akron, Ohio. So this is Grant Street in Akron, but I like to point out that this is also Akron, Ohio. And I think it is really important as we talk about revitalizing the community that we, you know, we choose what we focus on. And we need to focus on the good and on the bad and on the challenges and on the opportunities. But I would argue that a lot of times I think in our region in the past, people have focused so much on the past that it's hard for them to envision the future. So as we kind of go on our journey through Akron this afternoon, keep that in mind. One other thing that I like to say is that hope isn't a revitalization strategy, but it's a prerequisite for having one that actually works. So just kind of keep that in mind as we go through. So I won't give you a huge Akron history course because I think you guys are very familiar. But this is Firestone, obviously. This is where my grandfather worked and my great-grandfather, who was an immigrant that came here before he was in Pennsylvania mining coal, and before that he was in Hungary, and showed up in Akron, I think, around 1920 or so. And 1920 was kind of a seminal year in the city. That was the decade that Akron had tripled in population and was the fastest growing city in the United States. So we went from 69,000 to 208,000 people in that one decade. That's a lot of people. You know, we have 198,000 people today. So that was basically three quarters of our present day population in one decade. And these are just some numbers, and you can really see how the city grew and expanded over that time. We hit our peak in 1960. At 290,000 people, and we're hovering just short of 200,000 today. So with all the rubber boom that happened in the city, and that of course happened because of the automobile, that we were the main supplier for Detroit. We actually, in the 20s, built half of the tires on Earth in this city, and it brought a lot of wealth. So a lot of you guys might know where this house is. This is on Twin Oaks, just around the corner from West Market Street. A lot of the wealth in Akron went to the west side and to the northwest part of the city in particular. And that was really for geographic reasons. One is that it's on a hill, and two, that it is west of all the industry. And if you guys remember any of your climatology courses, if you ever took one, or just watch the wind blows from the west to the east here, and people could kind of be away from the pollution, which is a little ironic because a lot of the companies that generated that pollution, their executives moved to the west side, but really built some beautiful neighborhoods. And you know, the whole city was humming along in 1920, but a lot of the foundational wealth that built this city and philanthropy that's still here in a lot of our institutions happened at that time. So when Mayor Horrigan hired me in 2016, you know, one of the things that we talked about was we really need to get a good handle on understanding the housing market in the city and the dynamics of that. So my staff, who are great, by the way, a huge help, and we mapped when every house in the city was built. So this is just a little screenshot of kind of like the near west side of Akron. That's kind of Copley Road in the middle. You can see they're color-coded from when the oldest houses are to when the newer houses, and you can kind of see that triangle angling to the northwest, which was the streetcar line along Market Street, where a lot of the older houses in West Hill and Highland Square were. But we thought it was important to kind of understand when houses were built and what the market's like. And a lot of you, I think, are in this category. I am. I love my old house in Akron. I don't necessarily love putting money into it, but I love the end result of putting money into it. But a lot of the older houses we have in the city, they're already being cared for. And I think the challenge that we have is a lot of the older ones that are left are not all that viable today. There are people who are in the market for older houses, but there are a lot of people that are in the market for newer houses. I'd argue further that if we're going to fix those older houses, we need to get the market back running in a more functional way where it's cost effective to rehab a house. I was talking to Zach Cole, who's the director of the Well Community Development Corporation, the other day, and we were talking about Middlebury. And in Middlebury, it's not unusual to be able to buy a house for $10,000, $12,000. It's really not a $10,000 or $12,000 house, though it's probably really still a $90,000 house by the time you put all the improvements you need in, and then you might be able to sell it for $40,000. And that's, I'm not a financial wizard, that's why I was a geography major, but that's not a great return on investment. So I think one of the things we have to think about is how do we get the market functioning better in the city, and I have some thoughts on that. So this shows when, I mentioned the big boom decade of Akron, this is when the houses between 1901 and 1920 were built. And you can see they kind of make a ring around the core of the city. You know, everything in that donut hole was kind of already developed by 1900. And you know, everything outside of where those houses are was probably still woods or maybe even farms and not yet developed. So if I fast forward to the 50s, you can already see most of the houses by the 50s were being built on the edge of the city. And that was one reason we hit our peak population in 1960. So a lot of times people don't necessarily think about how cities lose population. There's been a lot of good research done on that topic. And what happened in a lot of American cities right after World War II is there were a lot of social trends geared toward having a smaller household. So you think about, you know, the divorce rate started going up, so there would have been a house with at least two people in it. Now there's two houses with one or more persons in it. People started having less kids. People started living longer, and therefore, you know, one spouse might outlive the other, and there's a smaller household. And so cities lost a lot of people in the late 20th century simply from smaller households. So Akron in 1960, 290,000 people. In 2000, 217,000 people. We actually had the exact same amount of households that we had in 1960. And that's because, and I think the other factor I didn't mention is people with kids started disproportionately moving to the suburbs for schools or other things like that. Bigger house, bigger yard, etc. So we managed to lose a lot of people in every American city, even New York, San Francisco, cities that have really come back were in that boat. They were losing people partly because of those demographic and sociological issues. But what started happening after the year 2000 in Akron especially is we just started losing households. And that's why you didn't really hear that much about vacant houses before the year 2000. I mean, they would be there, they would get torn down. A lot of times they would get replaced by one. One thing that we found that I shared with Mayor Horrigan early on that we wanted to change is we found that more houses were built in Akron during the Great Depression than there have been since the year 2000. So that's something that we actually really want to change and I would argue need to change for the health of the city. This is the value of houses in Akron. The lowest category is $35,000 to $50,000 roughly. That's red. You can kind of see that's clustered again in that ring right around downtown. And then the highest category in that map is houses that on average sell for $150,000 or more. That's the dark green. You can see in the northwest quadrant of the city that I was mentioning before, that's where overall the highest house values are. There are a lot of other parts of the city the house values are really stable. A lot of Firestone Park, a lot of Ellet, Goodyear Heights, where the housing market, you know, the houses are actually a great bargain. You can get a really nice house for $80,000, $85,000 and have a great place to live. But there is about a quarter or so of the city that the housing market is just pretty dysfunctional, that houses are, you know, they're undervalued, but they're in a lot of cases they're old. And then, you know, a lot of my colleagues from the fiscal office know this well. If the houses get too old or are vacant for too long, then you know, they start to get vandalized and end up needing to come down or, you know, have an intervention earlier. And that's something we're really pleased to be able to work and partner with both the county and the land bank on, because it does help us with that problem. Speaking of that, so I mentioned that we built less houses in the Great Depression than we did since the year 2000. The map on the left is where all the houses in apartments in Akron have been built since from 2001 to 2015. And the one on the right is where all the houses have been torn down in just the last 5 years. So we were tearing down, when Mayor Horrigan came into office, on average about 500 houses every year, which is a lot of houses for a city the size of Akron. We have around 95,000 housing units in the city, and 500 is about two per business day. So we don't want to have to tear that many down, but that's another, goes back to what I was saying before, how do you get the market working where there's enough demand to not have to do that? So I'll talk a little bit now about where we're going. So Mayor Horrigan, after kind of looking at some of this housing data we pulled together, came up with, I think, a great call to action for the city, and that was 250 by 2050. So what that is getting back to a population of 250,000 people by 2050. And before you say, not that you would, but before you say I'm crazy, just remember those pictures of Brooklyn and the Berlin Wall, because I really do believe that we can grow again and that we can be one of the best mid-sized cities in the whole United States. It's just a matter of, you know, how do we do that? How are we intentional and strategic? And so I'll kind of talk about three things real quick. It might seem odd to you, sometimes it seems odd to me, but people, when I would start talking about this, would ask me a lot, like, well, why do you care if people move to Akron? I'd kind of be like, well, why wouldn't I care about that? But because I think it's a great place. I live in Akron and love it. But it's a fair question, as far as I think sometimes what the people were getting at, which is a legit thing, is, well, isn't it more important to get jobs or to get tax base of income tax in particular? And of course we want that too. But I think one of the arguments that I've really come to embrace is a city is still a place to live, and you have to have people be able to lay their head down at night and feel good about living in the city. And it leads to a lot of other economic activity that might not be as overt as just recruiting a giant company with a lot of jobs, but it is important. So I'll just talk real quickly about the why. So on the fiscal side, is I've mentioned a couple times, Akron was built for a lot more people than we have, almost 300,000 people. You know, we're very grateful to the voters of this city to approve issue 4, which was desperately needed for core city services, public safety, and infrastructure. But we have the same amount of roads to pave in this 62 square mile city, whether we have 300,000 people or 200,000 people. We have the same generally amount of area to patrol with police and fire, leaf pickup, garbage pickup. Those core services, they don't really shrink. Sometimes they don't shrink at all with the population, but they definitely don't shrink proportionally with the population. And so getting more people in the city, the sewer project is a great example. Akron Waterways Renewed, that's our sewer and water ratepayers. You know, if we have more of them, there's more people to share in the cost of that project, which is still an extraordinarily expensive project, but that would help. The second thing is the things that I mentioned that are a little bit less overt and more covert, but a good example. So I grew up on the west side of Akron. That's where I live today. I can remember as a kid shopping with my parents at the Click store at Five Points, West Exchange and near Rhodes Avenue. And then we would start shopping at Gold Circle at Wallhaven. And then we would start going to Fairlawn. And then pretty soon we were going to Montrose. And pretty soon, if I wanted a hammer and some nails, I needed to drive 5 miles to Home Depot, unless I caught West Hill Hardware, which is a great place, by the way, when it was open. So, you know, and luckily we have an Ace Hardware back in the neighborhood now, but that's the kind of thing I think people don't always think about when a city loses people, is the city disproportionately lost people with disposable income, and retail follows that. So it's not an accident that, you know, places like Montrose or Green or Hudson or Stowe, where there wasn't a lot of retail 40 years ago, have actually most of the retail in the county now, and that's because people with money in their pocket to spend move there. And so I kind of look at that from two levels. One is it hurts all Akronites to lose those services, but especially lower income Akronites, really for two reasons. So a lot of the lower income people in the city either don't have a car or don't have regular access to the car. For grocery stores, basic retail, a lot of times they have to find a ride or use Uber or be on the bus. And it's a lot less convenient than just being able to walk to a store. And then secondly, those stores employ a lot of lower income people. And again, we have a lot of Akronites that leave the city every day on a bus to work at Walmart or places like that. And I think if we can grow our population, we can start to attract retail back. And then the third is probably the most important, and that's socially. So a lot of the neighborhoods where we do have, one in three houses remaining on the street, it does things to the social fabric of the neighborhood to have that kind of abandonment and vacancy. And the communities do lose, cohesion in a lot of cases and can lose hope as well. So I think this is another point related to the other ones. I really believe that residential development is economic development, and that, of course, there's a huge place, and a lot of you have read about Mayor Horrigan convening the Growth Council to look at our economic development strategy in the city, and that work's ongoing. But really diversifying our approach to economic development, and I think one part of that is looking at residential development. And I think downtown's a great example. So that's a rendering of the back of the Bowery project, which is at Lock 4. And that project, when it comes to fruition, is gonna get probably at least 150 new people living in downtown Akron, bring more retail opportunities. And even though you could look at that building as just an apartment building, I think its role in the city's economic development regimen is really important. So in terms of how we're going to do this, so I talked a lot about why we want to grow the city's population. Of course, how is a even better and more difficult question, but we're really looking at it through three lenses. So there are really three lenses that real estate is based on, and that's supply, demand, and location. On the supply side, one thing that we did earlier this year, with the reinvestment fund out of Philadelphia, has commissioned it to do a market value analysis of the city's neighborhoods. And what that did is kind of looked at the market strength, what houses are selling for, looking at our code enforcement data, where are houses in bad condition, where are they in good condition, all sorts of dynamics. I won't bore you with all the details of it, but suffice it to say, it looked at different levels of health in the real estate market in the city, really ranging from neighborhoods where the housing market functions just fine, houses kind of sell for what you would think they would, to areas that are quite distressed. And we had a couple of different presumptions as part of that analysis that I won't read all of them to you, but basically the idea that the city has to be strategic, that we have to be data-driven, and that we can't make a market happen where there's none, that we have to build on some nodes of strength and opportunity. So I think our big accomplishment on the supply side this year was to pass legislation to create a citywide residential property tax abatement program. And the way that program works, and if any of you don't live in Akron, keep it in mind if you ever want to build a new house, is that you're exempt from property taxes for 15 years over the balance of what you paid on that property before. So just a quick example, if you had a vacant lot and you were paying $500 a year in property taxes and you build a new home, all you would continue to pay is on the value of the land, and your home would be tax-free for property taxes for 15 years, which is really quite a savings for people, and I think a great way of attracting people back to the city. It's also true for apartments, so the same thing. Apartment projects that you've read about, the Bowery, Joel Testa's project at the former Holiday Inn at Cascade Plaza, those are all eligible for tax abatement. And it's a way of really helping the consumer. If it's a single family home, the person's getting a house really cheaper than they would get an equivalent house outside of the city. If it's an apartment building, the developer is able to charge less rent than they would otherwise. And you might ask, well, won't they just pocket that money? New buildings are expensive to build, and the rents that they would normally have to charge in a lot of cases just mean that they won't build the project at all. And so I think that's where the tax abatement is really important. And it's not a panacea, but I think it is a pretty powerful tool in the toolbox. On the demand side, so it's great to get more houses built in the city and apartments, and I think we'll really start to see that a lot in the next couple of years. But you still need to have reasons for people to live in those houses and apartments. So the demand side is really important too. So we are looking at, I won't get into a ton of detail on this, but if you have questions, we can talk in the Q&A. Working with community development corporations. So Mayor Horgan recognizes that the city has things that it's really great at, and it has things that it does maybe because it needs to, and then it has things that maybe it's better for other people to be involved in taking the lead. And I think a lot of the things in the city that involve the arts, or things that nonprofits do well, or things the private sector does well, are things that we really want to look more, how do we form partnerships with the entities that can do that well, and we focus more on some of the core city services that no one provides, you know, water, sewer, public safety, infrastructure, et cetera. Not to say we're getting out of the community development world. I'd actually argue it's the opposite. It's just more that we want to be strategic about how we leverage our time and resources to do that. So community development corporations are a pretty powerful partner, and they're people on the ground in neighborhoods that are nonprofits that can kind of help. I think one way they really help is they live in the neighborhood, they know the place well. The city, with some of our community development block grant federal funds, we're going to create a grant program for the CDCs, and you might have read the Knight Foundation is doing the same thing. The next topic isn't a real sexy topic, so I won't spend a whole lot of time on it, but it is important, and that's reforming our zoning code. So our zoning code, and just a real quick crash course on zoning. Zoning started actually in Euclid, Ohio, of all places, in 1925. That was the seminal Supreme Court case that enabled zoning to really take off. And it kind of grew up in the automobile age, but the idea was, and it made sense in the 1920s, people wanted to have their property protected from a rubber factory coming in and, you know, moving next door on Merriman Road, or, you know, anything like that. But I think the way zoning evolved over time is it started getting very strict about the use of properties. In some cases that's good, but in some cases, I'll just give a quick example. If you're an artist and you want to live in the upstairs of your home and be able to exhibit some of your work on the first floor, it's not exactly the same thing as having a slaughterhouse or a factory moving next door to someone. And so I think a lot of zoning codes do get a little bit onerous about that. And it does kind of stifle creativity in neighborhoods. And the other thing is people are really looking more to be able to walk to a store. And in some cases, zoning is so restrictive that it's very hard to develop any sort of retail, even low intensity retail. On the other side of the coin, zoning in the city is not very, and this is true in most cities, it's not very strict about how buildings look or how they're situated. And what that kind of leads to is the suburbanization of the city. So we've all seen this where you'll have a strip of great old historic buildings up on the sidewalk, and then I won't name any names, but somebody comes in and builds a retail use that maybe is set back a whole football field from the street with a big parking lot, and it doesn't fit the neighborhood, and it kind of does hurt the character of the neighborhood. So that's something we're looking at reforming. The other one I'll just mention in passing is parking. So this year we actually reformed the code with downtown residential. We used to require 1.5 spaces per unit. We no longer do that. We feel like the market can figure out how to park their tenants. We have no shortage of parking spaces downtown, which I'll get at in a second. But our code still has a minimum parking requirement, which means if you build a grocery store, we will tell you you have to build 300 parking spaces based on the size of that store. People can come in for a conditional use, which is a zoning variance, but it's one more step that they have to do, and a lot of times people just say, well, that's what the city told me, I'll build it. We really don't want people to have to build more parking than they, in a lot of cases, they don't want to build the amount of parking that we require. And that should be good. We should be able to trust them, I think, by and large, to know how many cars will park there. And having less parking does a lot of good things. It improves the neighborhoods aesthetically. It makes historic preservation easier because maybe the person won't be tempted to tear down that historic building next door because they needed to build a parking lot. And it helps with things like stormwater and our sewer project. So just two others real quickly, urban design, historic preservation. I kind of alluded to those, but they're really important. I probably don't have the time to do them justice in this presentation, but just suffice it to say we've got a lot of great historic assets in Akron. They're what people are looking for today, so how do we leverage that and build on that? And then a neighborhood focus and planning. So this year also, we crowdsourced this map, and what that meant is we worked with a guy I knew in Cleveland, actually, that had built this web-based tool to have people draw their neighborhoods and describe them. So the great thing about the cost to the city is that it was zero to do this, and he was willing to let us use that site. We put a new domain name on it called myakronneighborhood.com, and we invited members of the public to draw their neighborhoods, and then we used that to inform the creation of this map. And you'll see a lot of familiar names. We didn't radically really change the city's neighborhood map, but we did want to kind of give a fresh look at where are these neighborhoods and what are they called. And I think that's important as far as people's identity. So I'll just I'll go a couple more minutes here, and then we can switch to the Q&A. But in closing, I just wanted to talk about a little bit about downtown and neighborhoods. So I get this question all the time. People say, well, are you focusing on downtown, or are you focusing on the neighborhoods? And my answer, my truthful answer, is always yes, because it's we need both of them running on all cylinders, and they do complement each other. I think downtown, the goal is more to make downtown a neighborhood. Downtowns and cities for a long time were places to work and then places to play, so to speak, to be entertained. Those are both incredibly important. But we really need a 24/7 downtown where people can live. And there are a lot of opportunities for doing that. And then conversely, in the neighborhoods, we need to strengthen those business districts and bring jobs and retail back to the neighborhoods. And I think getting, you know, a better housing market, as I mentioned earlier, will help with that. So just a couple of slides. These are focused on downtown, but I think the principles apply throughout the city. This is from our downtown plan, which was done this year. Analysis of parking, 33% of all the developable ground downtown is devoted to parking cars. So that's a lost opportunity for a couple of things. That's a lost opportunity for, you know, places for people to live, places for people to work, places for people to be entertained. It's lost tax base, and it's a lot of water running into our sewers that we might not need to have. I think there are 14,000 parking spaces downtown, if you're keeping track at home. I think what that tells me when we look at demand for our parking is that we have enough parking downtown. I think what we have in a lot of cases is a parking perception problem and a wayfinding problem. So for example, there are 2,000 spaces under Cascade Plaza. I think a lot of casual visitors to the city don't even know that that parking deck exists. So how do we put it on people's radar? Through signage, maybe through web-based GPS-linked apps that can tell people where parking is. But I think it's fair to say we don't necessarily need more parking. We need to just use what we have better. So in downtown in particular, one of our goals is to focus on Main Street to, and again, that Bowery project, which is the landmark building at Bowery and Main. I think that's really a capstone project for the city to get going. There are some other great residential projects, the one at Cascade Plaza, things around downtown. What Tony here has done at Maiden Lane and on East Market Street, and then at Cascade Lofts. There's a lot of critical mass and momentum going on now around downtown. But Main Street is still where we have a lot of our historic buildings and kind of our center of the city. I kind of beat this one to death, so I wanted to go into more detail. But again, we feel like living in the city and in downtown is really important to creating vitality. public space, so it's another one I can't really go into the detail I'd probably like to, but we have a lot of great parks in Akron, especially a lot of great metro parks and some civic spaces. A lot of our city parks are, they're functional and they're nice, but they haven't really been looked at for design in a really long time. And how do we make them compelling spaces? I think Lock 3 is a great example. Lock 3 is a great entertainment venue and event space, but I don't think a lot of people even feel comfortable really going to Lock 3 if there's not an event, not for safety reasons, but they just, it's kind of, you know, there's no shade. It doesn't really feel that cozy of a space. And so I think with some redesign of that space to still be able to have concerts and things like that, but have it function as a great park. And I think almost every park in the city could use a fresh look. Enhancing health and safety through street design. So looking at our streets not just as ways to move cars. Cars are important. I would wager that all of us, myself included, got here in a car today. It's not that cars aren't important, but it's more getting a balance between safety for pedestrians and cyclists, public transit users, and cars. And so how do we redevelop the pavement? And I'd say a couple of silver linings in Akron. One, on the real estate side, as I kind of alluded to, we have incredibly affordable housing. Even if our property values double, we have incredibly affordable housing. We also have a lot of extra pavement when we were a city of 300,000 devoted to cars that we can potentially repurpose for either bike lanes or slowing traffic down a little bit and making it safer for pedestrians. Expanding on successful nodes of activity. So I think it's important to be strategic when we look at revitalizing the city, that we can't just do everything at once. It's a big city area-wise. I think we have to look at where do we have good things happening, how do we leverage those, work with the people that are doing those things in the private sector or nonprofits and or other public sector partners and make them go further. And then I think this has been a perennial discussion in Akron with the university in particular. How do we make the university, Stark State now as well, feel more tied in and connected to downtown? And similarly, how do we better connect downtown to the adjacent neighborhood? So I'll skip through these. I'll just kind of leave you with this one. This is kind of looking, just a real quick schematic of downtown, of some opportunities that are there and how they fit together. I think the Main and Exchange area near the stadium, that's a really important one that we identified in the downtown plan. That area across from the ballpark, I think there's a lot of interesting things that we could do with that area over time, as far as maybe getting new apartments in retail there that would take advantage of having the stadium. I think Buchtel Avenue, we could shrink it down. It could be almost like our East 4th Street that is up in Cleveland or something like that. Maybe that's not the right answer for that space, but I think thinking creatively about how we can take things that are surface parking right now and enhance them. And then Lock 3 and 4, the landmark building, the Bowery Project, very important. And then finally, I'll mention just real quickly the Inner Belt, so Route 59. That's a big opportunity for the city as well. And I think we're still at the stage of kind of early planning. How do we want to reutilize that space? Next year, it's already closed, but the project that you're seeing out there will be done. I think some of the types of things we're thinking about is green space and public space. I just read an article this morning about how linear parks can really enhance a city and draw people to the urban core. When you think about the High Line, it's a very different type of facility, but the premise of the High Line in New York was taking an old transportation facility and repurposing it as something else. I mean, who knew that an old elevated railroad would attract millions of people to New York City every year? So I think doing creative things like that with the Inner Belt, we really think there is a place for getting development on the Inner Belt as well, but I think you'll probably see in the short and medium term more beautifying it, making it look better, maybe putting in some public space people can use, and then thinking more about if there was bricks and mortar development, what would that look like? It's got some opportunities and challenges. The topography is kind of actually, I think, a boon for green space. The topography is a little more challenging for bricks and mortar redevelopment. There are ways to develop it still, but that's something I think the mayor really wants to involve the public in thinking about how that space is used. So more to come on that. So in closing, think about what I said earlier about fatalism and hope, and as the mayor always says, why not Akron? So thank you.
All right, so now it's your turn for questions. I've got a few in hand, and one of the privileges of being the moderator is I always get to ask the first question. So this is an important one that's going on right now. The Senate passed their tax plan on Saturday, early Saturday. The House has their plan. There are differences between the two that need to be reconciled. But one of the elements of the tax plan at this point that's still in there, it calls for the loss of historic tax credits, new market tax credits. If that does come to play, how much is that going to hurt what you're trying to do here in Akron?
Great question, very timely. I do think it hurts what we're trying to do if those tax credits are eliminated. We've done in this city with a lot of good, and I'll pick on Tony because he's here in the front row. I mean, Tony's really utilized in many, you know, many other developers over the years in Akron, Stuart Lichter at the East End, et cetera, utilized those historic tax credits to help make the numbers work. I think especially a more challenged housing market like this whole part of the country is, we don't have San Francisco level housing prices here, which is good 99% of the time, but if you're trying to build things or make numbers work financially, those tax credits I think are disproportionately important for a city like Akron. So we do hope that they say the mayor and council did put legislation forward to encourage Congress to keep those credits.
First question from the audience. Adding 50 to 60,000 people by 2050, where are they coming from?
Okay, that's a good one, and I didn't really address that, and I do get that one a lot. I think a lot of them are coming from real close to here. So I think this is something people sometimes, people who grew up in Ohio, maybe it's been the colored sports history, although, I mean, LeBron gave us that championship. I think we should still savor that. But I think a lot of times people in this part of the state feel like, well, there's nothing going on here. Nobody lives around here. I want to get out of here. This is the 15th biggest metropolitan area in the whole United States, Cleveland, Akron, and Canton. And there are a lot of people that live here. There are 4 million people that live within an hour's drive of downtown Akron. So I think, you know, 50,000 people over three decades in a region that has 4 million people, I think a lot of those people we can attract from fairly nearby. I do think there is a big role for, you know, we've had some positive population growth in North Hill with the refugee population. I think jobs obviously are important for drawing people here too, but I think a lot of the people, by and large, it's the city becoming more competitive in the housing market. When I mentioned, you know, there were less houses built here in the Great Depression, or in the 2000s than the Great Depression, there were not less houses built in Summit County during the Great Depression. There were a lot of houses being built, they just weren't in Akron. So I think this is our attempt to really be more competitive in the housing market.
What's the plan to develop amenities for downtown residents, such as grocery stores and retail?
Good question. So I think what people have really found now, and I'm not sure this was never not the case. I mentioned, you know, anecdotal story about where we would go shopping when I was a kid, but retail by and large follows rooftops. So I think if we can get people living downtown, that will attract more retail business in a way, because the one thing that I think hurts downtown retail-wise in a lot of ways is for a long time it's been a 9-to-5 downtown, and a lot of businesses need customers between 5 o'clock and 9 o'clock, or 5 o'clock and 10 o'clock, or whenever. Bars tend to do better downtown because, you know, people will come from elsewhere to go to them, but for a lot of, you know, retail businesses that sell things, they need people there in the evening. And, you know, visitors help, but having people that actually live there, it does get to be a little bit of a chicken and an egg. But I've had people say, well, nobody's going to live downtown if they have to drive to a grocery store. But my retort is always, well, you probably drive to a grocery store, right? I mean, how many of you know somebody who doesn't usually drive to a grocery store? I think just being realistic about our region, I don't think it's a fatal flaw for someone living downtown to drive for a mile to Dave's or the Mustard Seed or another nearby market. And I think over time, when you get enough people, you get a grocery store downtown. That's what happened in Cleveland. Heinen's opened at East 9th and Euclid when downtown Cleveland hit the 10,000 people mark.
Here's one question. If a potential resident wants to see all the empty lots available, where do they go for this information?
It's a really good one. So that's something we're working on right now to improve it. Right now, they can always contact my office, the Department of Planning and Urban Development. We have staff that that's their full-time job to look at the reuse of city property. But it is fair to say that I think that's not as easy of a process as it would be, because it does entail somebody knowing to do that, contacting us, then we'll send them some maps or spreadsheets, and it gets the job done, but I don't think it's unfair to say it's a little clunky. So what we really want to do is, and we're working with the land bank on this right now, creating a web-based portal where people can search for properties, where they can view all the properties owned by the city and the land bank. One reason we want to do it with the land bank is we feel like people don't care whether it's owned by the city or the land bank. They just want to know if it's available. And then once they find that out, yeah, they can get into the details of the different processes for selling them. But that is something that we're working on and hoping to launch in 2018, a web-based tool that will make that easier.
Jason, would you speak to the concern regarding how the property tax abatement will negatively impact the public schools?
So that's an important topic, and that is something that we discussed with the leadership of the schools prior to creating the program. I think that overall that program is actually going to be a great help to the schools, and here's why. In the short term, it's true there could be a couple cases where someone was going to build a house, and now that house is exempt from taxes and the schools are losing revenue. But I didn't mention this before, but there were 16 single-family houses built in Akron in 2015. So we're not talking about a lot of new houses being built, which hence the reason why we created the program. So I think in a lot of cases, things that are built new are things that wouldn't have been built at all. So it is really more a matter of looking at the math equation I always use is 100% times zero equals zero. So if you're getting all the taxes, but there's no new building there, you're not getting anything. In 15 years from now, which is kind of playing the long game, those properties come online. I think the other two things I'll just mention real quickly, though, if we get new houses and apartments built, they tend to raise the property values of all the surrounding properties, and those properties are not tax abated, and those properties will start paying more in taxes. And so I think that helps the school. The other thing is the schools have lost a lot of students. I believe the enrollment is about two-thirds of what it was even just 15, 16 years ago. So getting people back in the city is a great way of trying to boost the enrollment of the school. So I think it is complementary, especially in the medium to long term with the schools.
Has the University of Akron student housing been overbuilt?
I don't think so. I've looked at the numbers on the occupancy rates for those buildings. I know a couple of them have slightly tweaked their model for housing or what they charge, but I think they are, by and large, very close to full in all cases. I think the student apartments were really important downtown, really for two reasons. One is they got more people living downtown. But secondly, I think just for the look and feel of that part of the city. You know, when you sit in Brico today and you actually see a building, this is quick trivia, but that's one of, I've looked at this, is one of the only intersections in all of downtown Akron where there's actually a building on all four corners. And it makes the street feel really good. And I have an uncle that lives out of town that came into town a couple years ago, and we ate at Brico, and you know, he hadn't seen that area in a while, and it just, I think it was really impressive to him, and I think it does do a lot for the curb appeal of that part of the city. So I think we have the right amount of student housing.
We're powering through the questions here. I have a few more, but if anybody has any more ideas they want to throw into the mix, just scribble them down legibly and then wave your hand so that we can pick them up. I think something that a lot of people are feeling the pain of right now is the downtown road construction. This question says, it's a mess. Couldn't it have been planned better?
I think that, I feel your pain. And I guess my main counsel is patience, because I think we're at the light at the end of the tunnel. But a lot of what drove that was funding availability. So the city works really hard to get funds from other sources, federal, state sources. Sometimes you can't orchestrate exactly when those funds become available. Many of them are hard to get. So when we do get the funds, we're going to jump on that. So I think it worked out that a lot of the projects hit at the same time. And then underlaying all that was this once in, you know, every two, well, hopefully never again after this, you know, every 200 years, gigantic sewer project. So a lot of that construction also was overlapping. But I do think next year is gonna be a lot easier downtown than this year was with construction.
You want to give the room your cell phone number so they can call you next year? We got a question here about the Tent City that was in the news over the weekend in the Beacon Journal. What's the latest on the Tent City, and what's the plan for the city going forward working with Sage Lewis?
So I don't really have anything new to report that you probably didn't read in the paper, but I think if you read the letter that we sent, you saw that we really would like to work with Sage Lewis as far as helping the people that live there, keeping them housed. There is the letter mentioned, you know, there are some zoning issues that need to be addressed on that property. He had filed for a conditional use zoning variance and withdrew that, and the letter encourages him to refile that, because we do have a process to go through to, you know, try to make what he's doing legal. But I think it's important that we still sit down and talk about the needs of the residents and how those are best addressed.
And a follow-on from that for myself, as the city develops with a plan to add 250 by 2050, how do you ensure that populations that are on the margins aren't pushed out in the process?
So that's a really important one, and that's something that I read a lot about. And I think sometimes what happens in the national media, it's no secret, is clustered in New York and Washington for the most part. And a lot of the urban reporting is on what's going on in the housing market in those cities, which have incredible dynamism, extremely high prices, though. And so I think that in a city like Akron, the dynamic is just a little different. It is true that in some places in DC or San Francisco or New York, you see a phenomenon where property values are going up so fast and they're so high that people who have lived there, particularly if they're renters, they become displaced. But I would say even in those cities, it's most of New York, I would argue, isn't like that, even New York City. I think in our region, the dynamic is very different, that our prices are so low. I think it would be a long time before we would really have to worry too much about people being displaced. I think it's important enough now that we think about it. We should definitely be cognizant that it is an issue as areas redeveloped, but I would argue, I think if we don't work on getting new investment in middle class people back in the city, we have, you know, in Akron, and it's no different in Detroit, far worse actually, or Youngstown or Buffalo, where I could rattle off 80 other cities, concentrated poverty in your city with no middle class or no retail in many neighborhoods, it is not a strategy for success. So I think we need to find a way to get economic diversity back into the city, but yes, still definitely be aware of the needs of low-income folks and make sure that they're not displaced.
This one speaks to your transportation expertise, potentially. Have you explored the elimination of curbs to better manage pedestrian safety? There are European prototypes already in place.
I haven't looked at the elimination of curbs per se. I'll have to sit down with my engineering colleagues afterward and talk about that. I mean, we have looked at prototypes from Europe, for example, in Copenhagen. And I was lucky enough to go to Copenhagen recently with the Knight Foundation and see how they design their streets. But they're very intentional about separating pedestrians and then having a separated bikeway and then having the car traffic. So I do think there are a lot of things we can learn from Europe and other places in the world and in the United States to redesign our streets, but haven't looked in particular at no curbs.
We have a few more questions here. It's last call. If you have a question, wave your hand. We'll come around and pick up the card. The specific question on this one, what's the progress on the unsafe office building across from Portage Path School?
88 South Portage Path, very familiar with that property. That is something that we're working with Summit County right now in the land bank, which I believe is in the process of going through the process that the land bank uses to reutilize property. There are people, I think, that have reached out to the land bank that are interested in acquiring that property. I agree, I drive by it all the time. That building is not looking its best right now. So we are working with the land bank and the county to try to help mitigate that and get that site reused.
A timetable question. What's the general schedule? You mentioned the Bowery project. What's the schedule for it? Start date, finish date?
So that's a project that used a lot of different, in the what they call the capital stack of building funds to do the project, a lot of different tools, everything from our tax abatement program to those tax credits that we were talking about earlier. It's just about all systems go on that project. There's one piece of financing left that we're working with the developer on right now. And I think they're still slated to begin doing things to those buildings in calendar year 2018. And if I remember their schedule correctly, I believe their goal is still to get people living in there by late 2019. So it's a pretty ambitious timeline. I think they can do it, and we're looking forward to seeing it happen.
And I'll throw in one more here on scheduling. When am I going to be strolling on the Innerbelt Metro Park or whatever it's going to be?
I don't have a date for you on that, but I would say, you know, all of you and the rest of our counterparts across the community, we really are looking for input from people of what they'd want to see. There are a lot of neat things you can do in the short term that are somewhat temporary to reuse spaces, but I think for us it might make sense to start with testing some things on that space, but then beautifying it at the same time and getting it to where I don't think we want to be in a position where it looks like an abandoned road 5 years from now. You know, I think we need to do, even if they're low cost interventions, things to beautify it a little bit. My joke has been that it really doesn't look all that different now that it's closed from when it was open because it carried so little traffic. But I do think that we need to think short, medium, and long term on how we reuse that.
Ladies and gentlemen, Jason Segedy.
And thanks for being with us today.